Well, the thunder of puppy paws can be heard the length and breadth of the land during the Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race. Hi, I'm Ellen Lockyer, and welcome to Hometown Alaska. Although the furor of the Iditarod Trail is grabbing all the media attention this week, let's pause, no pun intended, a moment to consider some of the talents of man's and woman's best friend. Dogs have been around a long time, and no one remembers when the first one wheedled his way into a human heart, but it's a good bet it was thousands of years ago. And as the human race evolves, or progresses anyway, dogs have come along for the ride. They've always helped to hunt, or to protect property, or just to provide companionship for the lonely. But now, we're seeing some things dogs are doing that are out of the realm of the everyday activities we humans do. First, I'd like to introduce our guests for today on Hometown Alaska. Renee Leyland is the project coordinator for the Pet Therapy Project at Stone Soup Group. Hello, Renee.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And we'll be hearing a whole lot about their use of dogs in a fetal alcohol syndrome spectrum therapy project. And our other guest today, actually we have two other guests, and first I'd like to introduce Corey Aist, and he is the president of Alaska Search and Rescue Dogs. Hello, Corey.
Hi, thank you for having me.
And he's brought along Snap. Tell us about Snap. Snap is currently underneath the table.
He's mellowed out nicely, so... Snap is a 9-year-old chocolate lab, and he is currently operational with Alaska Search and Rescue Dogs in a couple different disciplines of avalanche, wilderness, and cadaver work.
Okay, well, welcome, Snap. We'll see if we can have a biscuit for you later. Well, speaking of avalanches, two of them closed the Seward Highway yesterday, and another one closed the Richardson Highway for a while yesterday, and avalanches are a pretty common occurrence in Alaska, especially in spring, and especially when we're having as much snow as we've had this past couple of days. Snap just woke up. Obviously, one of the duties of the search and rescue dogs is to dig out avalanche victims. So what's happened recently with your group and your dogs, Corey?
Well, as we all know in the community, the last couple of storm cycles have brought a lot of snow, and our slopes and cornices and mountains are just packed right now. And we participate when called upon. If there's an avalanche and someone's missing, we're called and try to help locate them. The search dog is one of the tools used, and there are several tools used in finding people located underneath the snow, and the dogs have traditionally been very successful.
And are certain dogs more adept at digging people out of the snow, and other dogs maybe trailing missing people? How does that work?
I guess you got to break up search into two realms first, so everybody's on the same page. And one is air scenting work, which would be avalanche in that case, or wilderness. And the other would be track trailing, where a dog is specifically following a scented trail, footprint to footprint, or how that scent would be transferred in the air, and it catches on different things like grass, bushes, buildings, things like that.
So how is that different from, like, you know, we're familiar with the canine dog, we're familiar with the police work dog, we're familiar with the seeing eye dog, but it seems to me that the scope of what dogs do to help humans in their daily lives is really expanding rapidly. So how would a search and rescue dog be a little bit different from, like, a canine dog in tracking a human?
Well, it's similar in many ways and different. The canine teams with the Anchorage Police Department are using techniques to trail criminals who are people of interest that they are trying to track down from a scene. And we're trying to track and trail or find people who are lost or missing within the context of a certain area.
You're so looking for people who would like to be found,
rather than
criminals who do not want to be found.
In many ways. And the tasks can be very similar, and the techniques in doing that can be very similar. And what separates us is maybe our dogs, We want them to be friendly. We want them to be we want them to find people. And so many times if there's a search for a child or a person with Alzheimer's or something like that, the police will call us because – and they may try it with their dogs first if they're if they happen to have a dog available and a handler who'd like to try that. But a lot of times they'll call us to come in and help facilitate that find.
Well, I can vouch for the fact that your dogs are friendly. Snap is now just about sitting on my lap, and he is dying to say something, aren't you? Come on. Well, there were some unfortunate incidents. A woman was lost and found frozen after a couple of days of search recently in Anchorage, and there was this very tragic double death with the snow machiners a couple of weeks back. Were your dogs called in at that point?
Yes, Alaska Search and Rescue Dogs was involved in that. We had several teams both participating in town here for that search for the missing woman and also participating for the snow machiner who was buried out in Grandview.
So these dogs, and I'm going to he's doing okay. It's okay.
It's fine. Yeah.
He's fine. He's wagging his tail. I want to just stop here for a moment and remind our listeners that Hometown Alaska is a call-in program. And if you'd like to ask us and our guests anything about today's topic of dogs helping humans, you can call 550-8433. That's 550-8433 in Anchorage or outside of Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752. That's 1-888-353-5752. Or email us at hometownalaska@kska.org. And remember, all of the information about today's guests and today's topic are to be found on KSKA's website, kska.org. So let's bring Renee in on the conversation. We were talking about how the abilities of our canine friends have seemed to have expanded exponentially over the last few years. And now we're you know, like we're used to seeing eye dogs or therapy dogs, service dogs, the dogs that know how to do certain duties around the house. But you have a kind of a therapy dog now that Stone Soup Group is working with or planning to work with that would be helping children with FASD. Renee, can you tell us about that?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I think dogs have always been helping people and being there for their needs. And we're, as people, just recognizing how we can use those skills and for healing. I work with, like you said, I'm a parent navigator for Stone Soup Group. And the way I got started in that is I am a mom of 6 kids. I have 4 special needs kids, and one of my children experiences autism, and one experiences fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And we have a grant at Stone Soup Group. It's a pilot program. We got $5,000 from the state of Alaska Department of Behavioral Health to kind of explore this. So we've got 2 pilot programs going on. They're actually classes at the animal shelter for kiddos. Well, I say kiddos, but there's 2 groups. One is under 12, and the other one is older than 12. And they work with shelter dogs. And the idea is to build confidence, unconditional love. There's a lot of pieces that the trainers themselves, we have 2 trainers that are very specialized in what they do, and I'm hoping they're going to call in and explain exactly what they do. But we're very fortunate to have that opportunity. The kids, I went to the last class, my son's in it, under 12, and it was amazing. There was a child who experienced some pretty severe cognitive impairment and was afraid to leave her mom. And by the end of the class, she's walking around with the dog and turning lights on. The dog is turning lights on, and she's giving, you know, strong commands. And it was just wonderful to see.
So the children that are included in the FASD group are work with the dogs at the shelter. Is that how that works?
Yes. Right now, actually, there's the 2 parts to it. The ones that are taught by Kathy Broom, who is a volunteer at the shelter, she specifically has a dog that she works with the young people. And then Carol Shea, who works with the younger group, she has brought in some of her own dogs that she uses that work with her in therapeutic places. Like, she goes to Mountain View Elementary and had some amazing results there with the children.
So the dogs themselves are not specifically trained to work with the children. It's more the other way around. The children work with the dogs.
Actually, you know, now that it's actually two parts, in that the older group, the shelter dog, is not specifically trained, and the kids sort of work with them to train the dog. The other group with the younger, there's three dogs there, actually. One is actually a therapeutic companion dog. And then there's one that's a puppy that the kids are going to get to train once they work with this other dog. So I guess it is two parts, the shelter dog and the therapeutic dog, depending on which class you're in.
That's great. And so the therapeutic dog, I know, and I'm no expert on this, but I know that for some time it's been noted that bringing fuzzy pets to homes for the elderly or to hospitals or to children in hospitals, It brings an emotional lift to people who are suffering in some way. And even, you know, just the smiles that your dog Snap brought to everybody. The minute that dog walked in, everybody rushed to meet the dog. Not the people, just the dog. Right. Oh, look at the dog. And it does evoke that in people. And I think that is something that anyone who's ever had a pet dog already knows. But I think medical science is starting to go, aha. And look, we have a caller. Can we go to line four? Hey, Carol, you're on the air.
Well, hello.
Hello.
Hi.
You called right on cue. Hi, Carol.
Hi. Just wanted to put in a few words. Renee got it absolutely correct. Our service dog and service dog trainers, two of the dogs that worked with the kids on Monday that Renee was referring to, are trainers. And we use the older dogs to train kids, everything from preschoolers to teens. And they have a wonderful capability of working with anyone in a therapeutic capacity to bond with these youngsters. And they know all the commands, as Renee was mentioning, everything from turning lights on to opening doors to picking things up. It's really, and that's what amazes the kids, doesn't it, Renee?
Yeah, it really does. The confidence just blossoms.
So they are dogs that are called service dogs and are trained to do small tasks. You said turn lights on. How does one train a dog to turn a light on?
Well, as Renee knows, we were basically demonstrating all the capacities and letting the kids just really understand what these dogs can do and then participate. And the turning the lights on and off, we work with a light switch board. So it's nose height for the dog. And then when they're actually, if they're actually going to be doing lights on and off for the individual with the disability that we place the dog with, then they learn to actually turn them off on a wall. But we don't want the dogs scratching walls while they're learning. So they learn on a light board, and the command to turn the lights on is lights. The command to turn them on is switch. And the kids were doing that with good, solid command. It's wonderful to see the capabilities of these kids when they're given a chance. So, and then, as Renee mentioned, we do have service dog puppies arriving, and when the kids learn the actual commands and do them well on the trainer dogs, then they actually start literally training a service dog puppy that will be placed eventually with an Alaskan with a disability. So there's the win-win aspect of this type of project.
Wow. So how do you select a puppy? Is there anything the dog itself has to exhibit as a puppy that would indicate that it would make a good service dog or therapy dog?
This is one of the huge problems in the service dog industry that makes me cringe. These particular dogs we have are literally from the litters of Dr. Bonnie Bergen, who founded service dogs. She has the Assistance Dog Institute down in California. And we looked long and hard to get a lineage of service dogs because they're temperament bred. So I do have a hard time sometimes with folks that just simply go to a shelter, grab a dog, you know, give it some behavioral training, and then say this is a service dog, because service dogs, we train them for 2 years and then hand them off.
Right.
And they have to be able to go into an airplane and into cars and Freddy's and a tire shop and behave beautifully. They have to be in the face of a two-year-old in a store and not take it off, but behave beautifully and appropriately. So it's a very specialized service dog, should be very specialized.
Right, just not any old dog can be a service dog. I mean, they have the potential, but it takes entirely a long, long period of training. That's what I'm trying to get at.
And temperament testing is basically what you were asking the question. Temperament testing
right.
is the big thing.
Right, right. Well, thanks, Carol, for calling in.
You bet.
We've got another line holding, but thank you so much for calling. And while we're on the subject of training, let's go to line one. Penny, you're on air. Hi, Penny.
Hi, this is Penny. I have a three-part question for Corey.
Okay.
I was wondering, how do you decide what type of breeds would do search and rescue, and how young do you need to have them, and how long is their training?
Well, the way in which we choose our dogs is individual on the handler, as Carol was speaking to. There are a couple of tests that you can run the dogs through puppies, when they're young. But it's a little bit of a shoot and miss type activity. What you're looking for in your puppy is drive and motivation. So you're going to want to do activities with your puppy, speaking for search and rescue, that might demonstrate that. So you might try to play with a toy with the puppy. You want to see that the puppy is interested in engaging the handler, and you also, in many ways, want to see how the litter is being raised. Is it isolated? Is the mom isolated from other activities around the house? I know when I chose Snap, I chose it from a family with kids who were handling the puppies every day, and I was fortunate that my wife went with me at the same time, and we picked the litter, and then she picked the dog. And we specifically chose not the alpha male, but kind of this what we figured might be the second in line for our own family needs. In terms of the training, it also takes two or three seasons to get an operational dog in search and rescue, depending on which avalanche or wilderness or tracking. It's an awful lot of training and activities.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question, Penny?
Yes, it does.
Okay, thanks for calling. Thank you so much.
You.
And if any of our listeners out there would have a question about search and rescue dogs or therapy dogs, please call us at 550-8433, 550-8433, or outside of Anchorage, 1-888-353-5752. 1-888-353-5752, or you can email us at hometownalaska@ksKA.org. And remember, all the information you'll need about today's program is on KSKA.org, KSKA's own website. So I wanted to talk a little more about other types of rescue. We mentioned missing persons, maybe elderly people who had wandered away, small children, digging people out of avalanches. I mean, Corey, how often are you called on in an average year to provide dogs to look for people?
Yeah, Alaska Search and Rescue Dogs is based here in Anchorage, and we get approximately 25 calls a year. That's about our average. Some years it's up to 30, some years it's 20. Or a little bit lower. It just depends. And we get called in a manner which is unique because of our location in terms of population density and also in terms of our location in terms of transportation, available transportation. So we fly a lot with the Alaska Troopers, Alaska State Troopers, or with the National Guard, or even with Alaska Airlines, depending on the location we're going to. And we will fly across the state to help find missing and lost individuals. I will I guess you could say 50% of our work is wilderness work. So just some type of environment out in outdoor wilderness forested areas or open areas. Maybe another 15% is avalanche. Another 15% might be cadaver work. And now what seems to be growing is our track trailing team's need in town. The Anchorage Police Department auxiliary search team calls us quite often to help in town, and they've been asking for our tracking dogs quite a bit.
Now, are the dogs interchangeable, or does each dog only respond to one human? Say, if Snap would go with you, you would go where Snap goes, but if Snap went with another person, would he work as well?
Well, I don't know if he would. We don't operate that way. The dogs definitely go with the handlers in which they train with. Just so it's clear, you know, all the dogs are pets in some ways, but they're also working dogs. And I think in the working dog area, all service dogs, the relationship with the handlers, the relationship with their owners is a little bit unique, because that dog is not only a friend, but it's also it's a tool, and it's something that you grow with. And as it gets better at the job, its life gets shorter, and it's kind of a unique experience. Anybody who works with dogs will have the experience of working with many dogs in their career.
Right, and it's you know, I worry about my dog. I'm going to outlive my dog. I don't like that idea, but
it's a terrible feeling.
Well, I've always had dogs, and I grew up in a dog family. So for me, the dog has always been there. But, you know, I guess that's not true of everybody. And I was wanting to get at the fact that as dogs become closer to the human race, dogs have become more and more in tune with the emotions of humans, and they exhibit a lot of those emotions on their own, too. The dogs, I know when my dog is happy or sad or pissed at me. When she eats my T-shirts, I know I've done something wrong. So, and it's the communication through emotion that I think is the catalyst behind this whole therapy dog thing. I know Renee Stone Soup Group did help raise money for an autism dog in Anchorage here, because your organization believes in therapy dogs. And it's the idea of communication with autistic children, or communication with a child with FAS. How do the dog facilitate that? What can the dog do that the parents can't do? I mean, I'm trying to get that in perspective.
Well, it's interesting, because kids and dogs have a special relationship. And a lot of times, I know in particular a family that we worked with to get a dog for their child who experiences autism. She explained to us that he was about 5 years old, and when he was about 3.5 or so, his grandmother had a dog, and he had been nonverbal up to that point, and he started spending time with that dog, and he started talking to the dog. Well, grandma had to leave and take the dog out of state, and he stopped talking. And so, you know, that was a huge piece. That's when she started looking for a dog that would really bond with her son and sort of help with some of the fears and the calming kind of thing. And and so that's when she got the Bichon Frise, and it's been, from what I understand, very helpful to this little guy.
Oh, I can see it.
Yeah.
I can see that there would be a bond of trust with a fuzzy little animal.
And, you know, the other thing, and Carol, I hope you don't mind if I steal your story, but when I talked to you yesterday, I thought it was so awesome. Carol was talking, and Carol, jump in if you want to add to this, of course, but she was contacted by a family, and they had a daughter who was in a coma, and she was unresponsive, and they didn't know if she could hear what they're saying or any of that. But the mom told the doctor that this young woman loved dogs. And so Carol was contacted. They brought in a therapeutic dog that they had. I believe it was a golden retriever. And the Goldie jumped up on the bed and was kind of snuggling with the young woman, and tears started coming down. And boy, talk about a connection, you know. Mm-hmm. And so with the kiddos who experience autism, a lot of times making eye contact is really difficult for them. And one of the things that I saw Carol teaching yesterday was they teach the dogs to watch them, to watch their eyes. And so there's various skills that they can develop as they teach the dog. So, yeah, two pieces.
That's amazing. Let's go to the phones. We have another caller. Kathy, you're on air.
Oh, hi. This is Kathy Broom. I'm working with a Stone Soup group at the shelter.
Well, thanks for calling in.
With the older kids. Pardon?
Thanks for calling in.
Oh, you're welcome.
Kathy, I'm so glad you called. Could you kind of explain... Or did you have a question first? I should say that. Or did you want to explain what you're doing in your class, which is probably a little different than Carol's?
Well, we have teens and adults who experience cognitive disabilities. And this is really a pilot project. I don't know of any place else that's doing this. But we bring the kids in. We train one dog at a time. We pick the gentlest dog in the shelter, and we teach the kids how to train the dogs while they're in the shelter. And we've had two classes so far, and the kids have been very successful, and they go out feeling very proud.
Wow. Because why is it? Because they have encountered something that they're successful at, or is there a
Well, if you know, if the truth be known, we all have disabilities. Nobody's able to do everything.
Right.
We have developed a pretty effective training program at the shelter where we just train one dog at a time, and we have been doing this for quite a while with all new volunteers who come into the shelter. They get a one-hour introduction to shelter dog training, and we teach positive training methods, and sometimes we have people with disabilities in the class. Anybody who wants to be a dog volunteer gets the class. So I knew that it could be done and that people could be successful using some very straightforward, simple methods. And so we are using those same methods with the kids who've been identified as being diagnosed with disabilities.
And are any dogs chosen out of the shelter, or do you have specific dogs just for this program?
No, we just take dogs that are up for adoption. And most of the dogs there are good dogs. They've already been trained, tested for temperament so that they... are for health and temperament, so they're all healthy, friendly dogs. And we just choose the dogs that are going to take treats gently and are going to be responsive to training. So we got a pretty good pool of choices most of the days, and it works.
Wow. And are these dogs, what if they are adopted out mid-program?
Well, that's our goal. So when we start the program, we tell the kids that we are training these dogs to keep them healthy and happy while they're there, that the kids are going to be the dog's therapists, and that while we're training them, it's going to improve their chances for success when they do get adopted. And we actually worked with two dogs last Saturday, and both dogs got adopted the very next day.
All right. What a success story. Thanks for calling in, Kathy. I appreciate it. Okay.
You.
Let's take one more. Hi, Stu. You're
hey,
on
I have
air.
A question. Thank you. I have a question for Corey.
Sure.
Hey, Corey, is it possible to have a dual-purpose dog, one that can go through all the training and be an effective search and rescue dog at the same time and take them ski-joring?
Is it possible to do that? It's probably possible to do that. One thing that we do in our group is we do encourage those who are interested in pursuing a search and rescue career to focus on that and that activity is a game of lost and found for the dog. And so you want in the search work because it's life and death at times because every family wants the best and most dedicated dog to that task to be looking for their loved ones. We want the game of lost and found to be the game of choice that dog always wants to take part in. Some of our handlers do other activities with their dogs, and it doesn't seem to be a problem. But most often than not, we try to focus and have a very specific activity that dog is always wanting to do when it goes out.
So if you actually had a search and rescue dog, then you'd probably try to keep him on task most of the time. You couldn't just take him for a walk in the woods and let him do his own thing?
Well, no, not at all. They're out walking all the time, and several of our handlers probably do ski jar and do other activities with the dog, play ball, or it really depends on the nature of the handler and the nature of the dog and the age of the dog and things like that.
Another question, is there a time limit? Do they get, can they just search on hour on hour, or do they, run out of energy after an hour and a half, or how's that usually go?
We definitely, dogs are as animals, just like we do, they have a time in which they are at optimal performance, and we try to build what we call search endurance into all of our teams. And so for wilderness in particular, to become operational, there's a 4-hour test in which that dog and handler are searching for that duration of time. And at the end, the dog has to alert, has to do what it was trained to do when it finds that person. It takes a long time to get there, but we've been on several searches in which the dogs were working most of the day, and you give them breaks throughout the day. You take hours, you take a couple hours to rejuvenate your dog, and then you go back out and you search an area. So they absolutely have a time limit in terms of what they're interested in doing. And in fact, searches are the worst training, because many times you're out there searching for hours and hours, and the dog does. It gets bored. It says, really? This is the game that this isn't what I'm used to doing. And so you have to go back and train the dog with lots and lots of praise and fun and rewards.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thanks, Stu. And we're ready for a short break. You're listening to Hometown Alaska on KSKA. We'll be right back.
If you missed part of today's program, or if you'd like to listen again to Hometown Alaska on KSKA, the show repeats tonight at 10. Remember, tonight's recorded rebroadcast will not be taking phone calls. Following this afternoon's broadcast, you can also find a copy of today's Hometown Alaska online at kska.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Hello, welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Today we're talking about dogs and humans and the things that dogs do to help humans along through their days. And my guests are Renee Leyland, and she is with the Stone Soup Group's project, which involves therapy dogs for FASD and other children with disabilities, and Corey Aist, and he is the president of Alaska Search and Rescue Dogs. And Corey, any memorable incidents in which your dogs were involved leap to mind? I know you get called to look for bodies, for missing people, dig people out of avalanches. Are there any happy endings that you can
absolutely
relate?
Once in a while you get to experience a live find. And with my first dog, Bean, we were called down to the Russian village down near Homer, and there was a 17-year-old runaway. And there wasn't a lot we could do in January. We couldn't do a lot of wilderness searching because of the deep snow in the area. But there were in the village, they had a lot of empty buildings. And so the task was to search the buildings and clear the buildings and make sure she wasn't in there. And there was a high-level chance that she she was having suicidal thoughts and things, so there was a little bit of urgency. And the third building we were in, we were fortunate, and we found her hiding in a crawl space. And the Alaska State Troopers came in behind us and were able to help take her out and stuff. And later, I guess what was most memorable, and I'm kind of connecting to the therapy dogs aspect. I don't quite understand all the aspects, but in these villages, I'm not sure I've heard or about the relationship between the people and dogs is not what it is nor in normal in our communities. And the family of the missing girl, the mom and dad came in and actually gave Bean a hug and said thank you to her. And it was, I guess it was a big moment for a lot of people because that's not the relationship that they have with many of their dogs. That's my understanding.
Right. Dogs are working animals. They're not really house pets. They don't even come in. I lived in the bush for years ago, and the dogs just never came in the house, period.
That's right.
And that has really changed. I mean, dogs used to be just dogs. Now they're like children. They're part of the family. And they do bring out those emotions and translate those emotions into dog emotions.
So many of our teams will respond to searches in which a search has been going on for many days, and a lot of the participants in that search, the volunteer searchers, are either down or, you know, they need a pick-me-up. And when the dog teams arrive, they say, oh, the dogs are here. Mm-hmm. Everything is going to be great, you know. And they're I always remember it, but back from the Oklahoma City bombing, there's a picture of a handler with his golden retriever that just became kind of memorialized as from that disaster down there. And it was just the aspect of the dogs and their participation and everyone comes and says hello to them at these activities, at these searches, and they do, amazingly enough, add some type of therapy to the event, some type of bonding.
Yeah, they do. Are certain breeds better at it than others? We see the popularity of black labs and chocolate labs. Golden retrievers are often mentioned. German shepherds, you know.
In search work, and then it's not necessarily the breed. You'll see all the working breeds from labs to goldens to Australian shepherds to border collies to German shepherd. I mean, just all, you'll see the whole gamut. It's back to the, is the dog motivated? Is the dog driven? And is the dog trainable? And it's the specific dog within the breed that you're really looking for. There's so many good dogs out there, and then getting them to.
So part of it is we'd be honing our human eye to look for, and Renee, I wanted to ask you, we think of the therapy dogs as maybe being the Bichon Frise, little fuzzy teacup chihuahuas, that kind of thing. But the lady in the training program said just about any dog from the pound was working out. So.
Yeah, you know, I really agree with what Corey said in that it really is, you're looking for that specific dog and you're looking for the attributes that help them bond with the kids. And sometimes the dog will pick the kid, you know.
Oh, yeah.
With my Bichon, when we brought him home, originally we were thinking that he would bond with our child who experiences autism, but he has bonded with our child who experiences fetal alcohol. And that's just how it is, because they really connect. But I think a lot of things sometimes go into that for the family. Like, for instance, the family who has a child who experiences autism that we had my dog's brother placed with, he had a cranial concern, and he was little, and so they couldn't have a big dog that would knock him down. The other piece is if folks experience asthma or somebody in the family, so they've got to have, you know, hypoallergenic dog. That's another piece. But, and you know, there are general, you know, like Corey was shaking his head, there are general breeds that you look into for finding your specific dog. But, you know, truly some of the most wonderful dogs I've ever been around are mixed breeds. Not to say that the pure breeds are not, because they're wonderful too, but we sure want to give you know, headlines to some of those wonderful other breeds.
Right. Mutts, good old Mutts. I just want to interject here that if you are listening and you have a question for either of our guests about therapy dogs or search and rescue dogs, please call us at 550-8433. 550-8433 in Anchorage and outside of Anchorage, 1-888-353-5433. 5752 or shoot us an email at hometownalaska@ksKA.org. And once again, a reminder that all the information you'll need about today's topic, which is dogs, would be on KSKA.org, our very own KSKA website. So we were talking about maybe this emotional connection and maybe small children who have, or even larger children who have a lot of problem communicating verbally, but intuitively have this emotional need to communicate. And the dog cannot speak either. But the dog can communicate through amazing body language and attitude. I mean, attitude is everything. Anyone want to comment on that?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And that's one of the things that's so cool about working with dogs and children is that the dogs, you know, the whole body language that and reading body language, that's difficult for some children who experience autism, FASD, and other brain differences. And so cueing a child into that, watch the body language, kind of helps them translate that skill into, you know, the human world. As far as therapeutic, actual measurable therapeutic benefits, we work with Shannon Cross, who is a therapist here in town. She used to work at a residential treatment center, and she had experience working with therapy dogs, and she has some wonderful stories and really good data on seeing how they made an amazing difference.
Hmm. Is it a trust issue?
Well, and that's the other piece that can be really healing, is that some of the kiddos have been abused. And when they're taught sort of a healing, a bonding, a healthy connection, that is very helpful. And I know Carol can probably speak more to this because she used to work with Alaska Children's Services, who works with some kids who have challenges. But,
well, I know that the equine, there's a mm-hmm. group in town, equine therapy, that horses have been long known to have some kind of bond with people who had, you know, disturbances, psychological or otherwise, or physical. And although most of us can't really keep a horse around, whereas a dog is a lot more a feasible alternative for that.
Well, and you know what's interesting is that's one of the reasons we picked the title of our pilot project is Pets and People Partnering for Success. And, I mean, we have one family who has a bunny, and that bunny is quiet and gentle. Sometimes other kinds of animals are quick and fast, and it frightens them. There's quite a few books out on, I think there's one called Horses with Angel Hair, or Angels with Horse Hair. That's what it is. I'm sorry. Anyway, it's about that, you know, the connection between animals and children.
And then maybe it's something that we have long, long bred out of the human race. And go ahead, Corey. You want to say something?
I think what Renee is, in many ways, and what you're speaking to is the nurturing effect that animals bring to people. I mean, they're the ability for emotionally disturbed children, or even they've got a lot of dog training programs in our prison system mm-hmm. that currently I'm aware of, where it's just giving those individuals the ability to participate in a nurturing environment, and it changes us in many ways once we can mm-hmm. bond and have that experience.
Right, the Iditarod Drop dogs are cared for at the Highland Mountain Women's Prison. That's where mm-hmm. they go, and there's a whole program out there where the women in the prison work with the dogs, and it's healing. It's healing.
It's amazing the ability of our animals, the ones that we have, you know, chosen to bond with, and the effects they have on us as people. And
let's go to that phone call that's waiting. Oh, hello, Carol. You're on air.
Hi. I'm chiming in again. Just to, you were hitting it right on the button with the value of the dogs and their bonding, and how children just respond to that. They in my practice and my jobs, working with kids and teens, with the abuse, the sexual abuse, physical abuse, emotional abuse, they do lose trust. Mm-hmm. And here you've got this wonderful animal that they can trust. It's an unspoken bond, as Corey was mentioning, and Renee. We use the dogs in everything from nursing homes to teen group homes, and I've used it in individual therapy, and just wonderful things they come up with. I remember a woman that I was letting a dog use in order to go into a psychology appointment with a psychologist at the Native Medical Center. The dog would lie on her feet when she started getting emotional, but it would calm her down, and she understood what the dog was telling her. Your emotions are rising. And then the fun part about it is one day the dog went over and put himself on the feet of the psychologist. And, of course, the lady said, "What's up, Doc, having a bad day?" And he says, "Well, you know I am." Huh. And so it is that sense. And we've even had service dogs that sense. There were a brother and sister that dogs could sense rising blood temperature in this youngster that had it, the dog as a service dog. Humans couldn't detect it, but every time in this particular young lady it went undetected, she was off in an ambulance. Hmm. But the dog one night locked the door and would not allow the caregiver to take this youngster into her bedroom. And they realized the dog was sensing this. And you know, all of a sudden, not just the youngster trusted the dog, but now the adults did too. And it's just, as Corey and Renee know, it's just endless, the experiences people have in children and adults when the two bond. And it's the bond. That's why the temperament is important for service animals and therapy animals. Of course, now we're using them to help with PTSD. We've placed two dogs with veterans with PTSD, and it has opened their life just tremendously. From a closed down fear to life is good because an animal has my back, and you know, that trust element.
Yeah, they're morale builders. Well, thanks for calling in, Carol.
You bet.
I appreciate it. I wanted to get a little more at the rescue dogs and what kind of missions they do accomplish. I have tucked this off your website, Corey, the total missions for the last, decade or so. And, you know, 15% are search, and some of them are water rescues. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about those?
Sure. So if we go back to it's lost and found, and it's kind of a game, and let's just take the wilderness context as kind of our starting point, then someone goes out into the woods and hides. And the dogs go out and locate them. And so once they get really proficient at that and they learn that's the game, you can change that. You can put the person underneath the snow, and now the dog knows that they're looking for someone underneath the snow. You can put someone in some rubble for disaster work, and they're looking for them in rubble. And you can put them underneath the water. And the dogs know that the person is underneath the water, and they just have to locate where the scent is coming up. And so all, you know, as our bot, you know, underneath the water, you're looking for someone who's deceased, and as the body decays, gas bubbles are coming off, and as they rise to the surface, they pop and let off that scent, and that's what the dogs are keying off of.
Hmm. You said, like we talked earlier about finding a missing person, and the dog can detect the scent on a leaf or a twig or the ground or underwater even. But what about, like, say, an earthquake rescue where it would not be a specific scent? It would be just anybody that they could dig out. How does that work?
Right. So that's a little bit the difference between air scenting and track trailing, where track trailing would be scent specific. So we would the dog would get a scent article, a sock, a pillowcase, a hairbrush, something that was specific to the person they're trailing after. And in air scent work, they're looking for anybody who's in those areas. You're not using any specific scent source. So in disaster work and rubbles, any scent that is making its way to the surface through the rubble, the dog is trained to bark or indicate that that's the location of that scent, and that's where they are, usually.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to think of you went to the Oklahoma City bombing?
No,
you didn't go to that.
No.
Okay. Any really major disasters that the Alaska dogs have been involved in at all?
No, not for us. We've been contacted a couple times, and I think it's more of just feelers. As something happens, you know, when 9/11 happened, we got a call from New York, and they were just seeing what resource we had. I think at that time nobody knew it was going to come next, and there was probably a logistics team that was set up to find out what is the dog resource around the country, and we came up on that list, and they wanted to know what we could do. There was an email going around for looking for some cadaver dogs to go down to Haiti, and they wanted some specific criteria, which at this time none of our dogs quite are there. But those type of experiences are very challenging on dog teams in general, and many times they can be career killers, as they say. It's tough conditions. It's really hard on the dog. It's really hard on the handler. And when they come, you have to train for that. You have to be ready for that experience. And many of the teams that work in Alaska really want to provide the resource for our community and for what we need up here. So disaster is kind of an interesting area. There will be another big earthquake, and the effect of that earthquake here on our we don't know exactly. If there's some buildings and some rubble piles, we will definitely participate along with the Anchorage Fire Department or any other resource that's needed until other teams and FEMA teams, you know, arrive from the lower 48.
Mm-hmm. Now we have an email here from Jessica, and she knows you. She knows Bean, and she wanted to know, is there an average length of time? What is the, not the lifespan of the dog, but the span of years in which a dog can be a successful search and rescue dog?
Yeah, most teams probably retire somewhere between 9 and 11 years old. That's pretty old for the dog. They know the game very well, and cognitively, many times they're at their peak. But of course, their bodies are giving up a little bit. They might have some shoulder issues or elbow issues or back issues, and their minds are ready for the task, but their bodies are not quite up to it. Mm-hmm. So that's about the length of time, and that's a pretty good career if you could get 10 years.
10 years
out of your working dog. It's it's a long time.
We have a couple of other questions, Renee, Chris, and Karen. Renee, I'm sorry. I'm looking at the email. You may have to be able to answer this regarding a special needs a service dog. A very expensive dog is brought into a family that may already have a pet dog, just a pet dog. Would these dogs get along? Would they be?
You know, I'm not. It probably depends on the dogs. I think what I would do is wherever I got the service dog from, I would check with them to see what kind of training the dog had. Maybe even have because that pet dog is part of the family. It has to be a cohesive unit. Mm-hmm. So I would want to include them as I would another sibling in the.
That would be a shame,
together,
though.
Yeah,
if you didn't get along.
And it's a tricky thing sometimes because everybody has their own personalities, even dogs. But I would definitely check with, you know, wherever you get the service dogs. Carol would probably know a good contact in that arena as well.
And another email. We got quite a slew of emails. Can rescue dogs be trained for service dogs? Can rescue dogs double as service dogs for vets? Corey?
I don't see why not. A dog that is specifically trained for search and rescue can do lots of other activities. So, and they're already, they probably already have a temperament that would be conducive to that activity. And
I was going to say, Corey, you know, Snap is being a therapy dog to me. I was quite nervous when I was in here, and the Snap came over, and I was just felt like, oh, this is so good. You know, life's all right. It's going to be okay.
It's an energy thing. It's an energy you pick up, that the happy, good-natured exuding of love and affection that just wells up from some of these animals.
Yeah, and I would, you could probably stretch it and say that most good service dogs, whether they're doing what Renee is asking them to do or search, or even, you know, we haven't touched on it, but dogs for the blind and all those aspects, you could probably pretty much guess that their temperament, their drive and motivation and all those elements are there in that specific dog. It's trainable. It's, you know, it bonds well.
Is there such a thing as a one-man dog?
Oh.
I'm looking at you, Court. Well, you know, I really see where, like, for instance, my dog that came into our home and has really bonded with my son. And I think because their temperaments are similar.
Yeah. I don't know if there's one person for the for a person. I don't know, but it did. I will say this: when I lost Bean, it took me a long time to bond with Snap. He had to earn it. It took a while, and he didn't get Bean's chair, not for a long time. So it takes a while, but my guess is that we're going to bond with many dogs along the way.
Yeah, we live longer.
Yeah.
I went 3.5 years without a dog after my wonderful Katie died. I just couldn't.
They are parts of our family, and we need time, just like when we lose the loss.
Right. We talked a little bit earlier with Renee here about the connection, the dog intuiting the rise in emotional level of the person. And there's an email here about diabetic dogs, and we've talked about that a little earlier. We Stone Soup Group did help fund a diabetic autism dog for a family in Anchorage, and apparently dogs have an ability to detect blood sugar level changes in diabetics. I don't know anything about that. Can you comment on that, or is there something?
Well,
I can give it
a shot. The dog actually that we were able to work with in placing with the family, the child experienced autism, and not diabetes, because I think that's probably a real specialized field the dog needs to specifically be trained for that. But as far as, you know, listening to Carol and her experiences in the hospital and around the medical community, you know, I think definitely certain dogs can do that. And the trick is training us to figure out which dogs are the ones that can do that.
It's probably a scenting. Their keratone levels and you know, it could even be on your breath, the amount of sugar that's coming out in your breath and things. I mean, the dogs really can, you know, I've read about a dog that could find cancer underneath the skin, and it's a...
Okay, and exudes like garlic. You can smell it from the pores. We are running out of time, and this has been a delightful hour. See, I told you it would go fast. And thanks to my guests, Corey Aist and Renee Leyland. Next week, host Tika Ballas will take your calls and hear your experiences about successful single parenting in economic hard times on the next Hometown Alaska on KSKA. And I'm Ellen Lockyer, your host. Thanks for listening in. Pat Yak is APTI Vice President of News and Public Media. Kristen Spack engineered today's program with assistance from Constance Huff. You've been listening to Hometown Alaska on KSKA.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated News and Public Media. An archived copy of today's program, additional information, and links to all the websites mentioned on today's show are available online at kska.org. Send us your comments and suggestions of things you'd like to talk about at Hometown Alaska, 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. This is KSKA Anchorage.